The scripture today is from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 18, verses 1 through 14, and it's found on page 974 of the Bibles you have either in front of you or right next to you. Would you please stand for the reading of God's word? At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, "I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. But if anyone causes one of these little ones who believed in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. See that you do not look down on one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. What do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders off, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go to look for the one that wandered off? And if he finds it, I tell you the truth, he is happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost." This is the word of the Lord.
The song that Janelle just sang asks several intriguing questions. What if my greatest disappointments or the aching of this life is the revealing of a greater thirst this world can't satisfy? It then goes on to answer those questions. When friends betray us, when darkness seems to win, we know that pain reminds this heart, this is not our home. It's not our home. C.S. Lewis once said, "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." And that is what we've been talking about over the past several weeks. We were made for another world. This is not our home. Jesus keeps talking about a different kind of king who rules in a different kind of kingdom. A generous, powerful, and demanding king who rules a coming, counterintuitive, but complete kingdom. And today, as we approach the fourth of the great discourses of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 18, we'll move from asking questions about the king and the kingdom. What kind of king rules the kingdom? What kind of kingdom does the king rule? We'll move to asking three new questions as we look at Matthew 18. What kind of people enter the kingdom? Why is it important to enter? And what is on the king's to-do list? And we're going to be walking all the way through the entire chapter of Matthew 18. And so I'd invite you to, if you brought a Bible, open it, or you can grab the Bible right from underneath the chair in front of you. And open to Matthew 18, because I'll be summarizing some of it, and it'll help you understand the flow of the chapter and how Jesus is moving the people to whom he's talking, if you can kind of see it visually, how it's laid out right in front of you. And so let's start with verses 1 through 3. The disciples asked Jesus, "What must we do to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" That's how it all starts. It's this whole idea of who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Quantify it for us, Jesus. And isn't that just like people? The most popular sport in America is football, and every 3 feet is marked out with a hashtag on the field. Not a hashtag. Sorry, that's Twitter. A hash mark. I don't even tweet or anything. I can't stand that stuff, okay? So scratch that. A hash mark on the field, because we want to know exactly where we are. How do we measure up? How do we measure up? They're considering getting rid of ties in football because nobody wants to see it end in a tie. I see Glenn over there. I think they got rid of ties in hockey. They have shootouts now in the regular season because everyone wants to know who won, who lost, who's first, who's last, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, the disciples asked Jesus. And Jesus says, I'm going to be blunt with you. Unless you change and become like little children, you're not even going to get into the kingdom of heaven. Stop talking about this idea of the greatest. It's not quantified like that in heaven. You must become like children if you're even going to enter the kingdom of heaven at all. But when I read Jesus saying, become like children, my mind immediately goes, I wonder what attribute of children he's asking the disciples and us to embrace in order to gain entrance into the kingdom of heaven. Because anyone who has kids knows that while kids may be cute, they may be fun sometimes, not everything about kids is great. They don't always behave well. Sometimes they do crazy things. Sometimes they make huge messes that you have to clean up after. And so when Jesus says, become like children, what attribute of children is he actually talking about? For surely he's not talking about this. The other day, my wife went looking for our daughter Leela, our youngest daughter Leela. And she was nervous because she saw the bedroom door to Sophia and Olivia's room was wide open. And Leela loves to push that door open. And because the older girls, they have bunk beds. And she climbs up the ladder on the top of the bunk beds. And she dances precariously close to the edge of the bunk beds. And so Nina was so nervous, she was up there on top of the bunk beds. And she walks into the room and she's not there. So Nina takes a left and looks toward the bathroom. And this is what she sees. What attribute of children is Jesus talking about? Surely it is not that children don't mind hopping in a toilet and, you know, seeing if they're an early swimmer or not, you know? And so Leela is in the toilet there. We are a little concerned about the diseases that she could be, you know, obtaining at the time. And I will tell you, at this moment, though, the attribute that Jesus talks about in verse 4 is still revealed. Even as she is in that toilet, what Jesus is talking about, what he actually wants us to imitate, you can see. Because in verse 4, Jesus tells you clearly what attribute of children you must embrace if you're going to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's humility. You must humble yourself like a little child, Jesus says. Because there's one thing that Leela knows that all kids know, even as they're sitting in the toilet. She can't get herself out of there. That's what she knows. If you walk up to her, and if you walk up to your child or any child, whatever situation they're in, you walk up to Leela in the toilet and she reaches for you. She knows she can't climb out on her own. If you see a child playing with their toys on the living room floor and you walk over to them, they will reach up because they know they're not going anywhere without you. Every morning when I take my two older girls to school, Leela is always clamoring to have me pick her up. She wants to go along for a ride. There's a humility about children because they know one thing. They know they are absolutely dependent on their mother and father. That's where the humility comes from. They don't think more highly of themselves than they ought to. They know they are dependent, and they embrace their dependence on their mother and father. What kind of people enter the kingdom? Dependent people enter the kingdom. people that are dependent on the King. And so this morning, I just would like to ask, did you show up independent or dependent this morning? Did you show up thinking you can get life done on your own, or did you show up with a dependent attitude thinking, unless the King pulls me out of whatever mess I'm in, I'm going to be stuck in the morass that I've created with my own actions and behavior and sin? I mentioned last week that I'm fond of C.S. Lewis's series of children's books, The Chronicles of Narnia, and I read to you from the introduction. Well, there's a great illustration of our dependence on the King to pull us out of the messes that we make in our life. In the third book in the series, it's called The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And there's a boy in the story. His name is Eustace. And you see on this particular cover of the book, you see a dragon. You go, why did the dragon get on the cover of the book? Well, the boy Eustace is very self-absorbed. He's very self-centered. He's very prideful. He's very arrogant. And one day, he's transformed into a dragon. And it's a sign and a symbol of what our sin does to us. Our sin dehumanizes us. It makes us less than what God created us to be. It makes us beastly. And so he turns into this dragon. And at first, he's okay with it. And as he goes on, he realizes that being a dragon is not who he was made to be. He was made to be a boy, a human being. And he's desperate to shed his dragon skin. And in one scene, the lion, his name is Aslan, who represents the King in the story, represents Jesus in the story. He comes to Eustace and he says, go ahead and undress. Why don't you try to get the scales off yourself? There's a pool. You can wash in this pool. And Eustace, as the dragon, goes down into the pool and he starts scratching. And he's excited because his skin starts flaking off. And then he goes to get in the pool and he looks down at his arm and he sees that the scales have grown back thicker and tougher than before. So he does it again and he does it again. And each time he scratches it off, but it always grows back. And then we read these words. Then the lion said, you will have to let me undress you. I was pretty afraid of his claws, but I was nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat down on my back and let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked a scab or a sore place, it hurts like billy-o, but it is such fun to see it coming away. I know exactly what you mean, said Edmund. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there I was, smooth and soft. You see, what kind of people enter his kingdom? People who realize they are wholly dependent on the King to get the scales removed from their life. To have a moment where Jesus comes in and cleanses us and forgives us, and we realize that our sin was so much darker and more knobbly than we ever thought it was before, and we say, I could have only dealt with that sin by your grace and your power, Jesus. And for centuries, the church has called this realization that salvation comes from full dependence on the King. They have a word for it. The church has created a word to describe this process. They call it justification by faith. Justification means just as if I'd never sinned. The King comes and he makes it just as if I'd never sinned. And you read these great words in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. For it is by grace you have been saved, through faith. And this is not from yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. There's nothing that we can do to get rid of that dragon skin that we all know of as sin. The people that enter the kingdom are wholly dependent on the King. They're saved, justified by grace. And it's a free gift to anyone who would want it. But what if I want to stay independent? What if I like being independent? What if I don't want to go through that process? You hear the boy Eustace, he said, when he dug in that first cut, it penetrated so deep, I thought it was going to go right into my heart. I thought I was going to die. I don't know if I want to go through that process of transformation, that process of becoming dependent on the king. What if I want to stay independent? Is there any compelling reason why I should admit my dependence on the king and enter his kingdom? And this leads us to our second question. Why is it important to enter this kingdom? Why is it important to enter the kingdom? Well, Jesus goes on after he talks about the dependency that we need to enter the kingdom. He goes on to use the word better three different times. If you look at verses 6, verse 8, and verse 9, you see Jesus uses the better. It would be better for someone to have a large millstone running around, hung around his neck. It would be better for you to enter life maimed or crippled. It would be better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. What is he comparing this to? What is better? He's talking about having a millstone hung around your neck. He's talking about entering life maimed and crippled with no hands and no feet. That's better. What does he mean? Better. Jesus is alluding to something that he has actually discussed throughout the Gospel of Matthew up to now. We just haven't been able to touch on it on a Sunday morning. What he's alluding to is the idea that there really are two kingdoms. There's not just one kingdom that he is attempting to say, hey, you need to enter this kingdom. He's saying there are actually two kingdoms here. And trust me, it's better for you to enter my kingdom maimed than for you to enter into the other kingdom. It would actually be better. It would be better to have a large millstone hung around your neck and drown in the depths of the sea than to have to go to the other kingdom that I've been telling you all about. It actually goes back to Matthew chapter 4. We studied this in our Ash Wednesday service. Jesus makes it clear that there are two kingdoms. Excuse me. Matthew makes it clear through the story he tells in chapter 4 that there are two kingdoms. And Jesus wants us to enter his kingdom and to make sure we don't enter the other kingdom. And there's a name for the other kingdom. And it's right here in Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. It says, again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. What's the name of the other kingdom? It's right there in verse 8. The devil showed him all the kingdoms of this world. There's the kingdom of the world, and then there's the kingdom of heaven, Jesus says. And you're going to enter one of these two kingdoms. And I'm telling you, you need to enter my kingdom, the kingdom of heaven. He goes on in Matthew chapter 13, which we studied last week, in verses 24 and following. He tells the parable. In all these parables of the kingdom, he says there's a parable called the wheat and the weeds. He doesn't say it's the parable of the wheat, the kingdom of heaven. It's the parable of the wheat and the weeds, the kingdom of this earth versus the kingdom of heaven. He goes on at the end of that chapter to tell another parable about some fish. And some fish get brought in to be served at the banquet. And some fish are thrown away in fire. And we learn that the kingdom that Jesus rules is a coming kingdom. And Jesus says, look, there is a day, there is a time. It is coming. Trust me, you want to enter life. It is so important to enter life. It's so important to enter the kingdom of heaven. It would be better for you if you have to enter it maimed or crippled. If your hands or feet are causing you to do things that will keep you out of the kingdom, or if your eye is causing you to do things that will keep you out of the kingdom, it's better to poke your eye out. That's how important it is to enter the kingdom. And it is a coming kingdom, as we talked about last week. It's the NCAA basketball tournament. And they were interviewing one of the coaches after he won the game, and they were asking him about some of his strategy and how he won the game. And he said, you have to realize the second hand on the clock never goes backwards. You have to realize the second hand on the clock never goes backwards. There are two kingdoms, and they are coming, and we will either live in one of those kingdoms or the other. And Jesus says, we must make every effort to enter into his kingdom. It is exceedingly important to enter the kingdom of heaven and reject the kingdoms that this earth offers us. And so, if Jesus' kingdom is exceedingly important, when we keep reading, we learn that Jesus is doing two things to make sure people have the best shot possible to enter the kingdom. And again, some of this stuff is not very easy to talk about. It'd be nice to maybe skip over that little part, but that's the reality of what Jesus is saying and what is coming. And so Jesus says, because that's coming, I'm going to tell you what's on my to-do list to make sure people have every shot to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And I call this the King's to-do list. Here are the two things on the King's to-do list: searching and forgiving. What's the King doing to make sure people enter his kingdom? He is always searching. He is always seeking to forgive people that ask. It's on his to-do list, day and night. He never stops. And that's some of what he spends the rest of this chapter talking about. I'm a king that has a to-do list. On my to-do list is searching and forgiving. Let me tell you about the searching. We have the parable of the lost sheep in verses 10 through 14. And in these verses, you see a shepherd that has 100 sheep. And one of the sheep wanders away. And Jesus says, do you think the shepherd will go after the one sheep and leave the 99 unattended? Now, that's not a slam dunk case. We may have become so familiar with this story, especially because it's made very famous in Luke chapter 15, where Luke puts this story next to two other stories that Jesus tells about lost things. And it's just become so famous, we think, oh, the shepherd has one sheep that leaves. It's so obvious you would go after that one sheep. Not if you ask a shepherd in the first century. There's great danger in leaving the sheep alone. You've only lost one. If you go after that one, you risk losing the 99. But Jesus makes it sound as if in God's economy, from King Jesus' perspective, it is so obvious you go after the one. The shepherd takes the risk simply because it's too devastating a thought to think that someone would be left out of the kingdom. It's too devastating a thought to think that someone could end up out of it. And so the shepherd says, it's worth the risk. It's a risk, but I'm going after that one. What does this mean if you came to church this morning and answered the question, are you independent or are you dependent right now? Are you independent of the king or are you dependent on the king? What does this mean for you? It means you matter to the king. The king is willing to risk everything to go after you. You matter so much. The lost sheep matters to the shepherd, and lost independent people matter to the king. He goes after them ruthlessly, almost even recklessly. You matter so much to the king. He is pursuing you right now. I would encourage you to go back through your day. If you said, yeah, I'm kind of independent, I haven't made that choice to become dependent on the king, go back through your day and say, how did I really show up this morning to hear this crazy guy talk about this? And I bet if you really examine it, you'll see God's story intersecting with your story, God weaving in your life and drawing you to this point because he wants you to hear that you matter to the king. He's willing to go after you. What else? Well, when you're found, if you're lost and you're considering being found here, if you're found or if you're already found, you've said, I've been dependent on the king for a long time. What does that mean? Finding in the story leads to rejoicing. That's what it means. There is rejoicing in the kingdom of heaven when something that's lost gets found, when someone that's independent of the king becomes dependent on the king. There is great rejoicing. There once was a student that I was good friends with and a He was a great partner in ministry when I served here at the chapel over in our student ministry department. And it was the day when he was supposed to hear from the college that he really wanted to go into. It was the University of Virginia. And the University of Virginia is not easy to get into. And he was here working on his mentorship at the chapel, and he was going to leave, and he said, I'm going to go home and see if I got into the University of Virginia. And I said, why don't you use one of the computers here? Let's find out right now. I said, you can go to Luke's office. Luke is an alumnus of the University of Virginia. His computer has good UVA mojo, okay? I said, Luke will stand there with you, and he'll put his hands on you. We'll all gather around. It'll be this great moment. So I talk him in. I say, you got to find out if you got in or you're out of UVA right here, right now. And so we go into Luke's office, and Luke has like a big UVA flag up on the wall. Luke puts his hands on his shoulders, and he clicks this button, and it says, congratulations. And I'm telling you, the sound in the room, in the office, it was a little tiny office. There were like 8 of us in the office. It was just deafening. People started screaming and hugging and high-fiving. And Philip, this is Philip. Here's a picture of him at UVA right now. There he is. He's all excited. He's about to graduate now from UVA. And he's all excited. And he runs out of the office so excited to go home and to celebrate this news even more. And as he runs out of the office, Luke looks at me and goes, what if he didn't get in? I go, yeah, that would have been awkward. But he got in. He entered into the University of Virginia, and it led to rejoicing, screaming, deafening volume, high-fiving, and running out of the office. That's just getting into UVA. How much more rejoicing will there be in heaven when someone who is lost becomes found? The King is searching for you, and he is ready to rejoice and celebrate with you when you make that move from independence to dependence on him. Well, there are two kingdoms, and so the King's to-do list includes constantly searching for people who are lost and wandering in the kingdoms of this earth, and he rejoices when they find rest in his kingdom. The second thing on the King's to-do list is forgiving. And that is verses 23 down to about verse 27. It's called the parable of the unmerciful servant. And in this parable, you see these words, the kingdom of heaven is like, and it's like a king that's going to settle accounts. And so he brings a servant in, and the servant has a major debt. And the amount of the debt is important to understand because this servant has a debt of 10,000 talents. And we can just read right through that little detail. Go, 10,000 talents. I guess that's kind of large. This is unpayably large. There's no way the servant could ever pay this back. One talent equals 16 years' wages. So just take whatever you make in a year, multiply it by 16 years. Now he owes 10,000 talents. That's 160,000 years of wages. This is a little more than a 30-year mortgage that needs to get paid back. The point of the story is the debt is so big that no one, not even the wealthiest person reading this story, can ever imagine paying back 160,000 years worth of wages. And the king cancels the debt. God is in the forgiving business. He forgives debts that are too large for us to pay. For our debt of sin was so enormous, the only thing that could pay our debt of sin was God himself giving himself through the person of Jesus Christ on the cross. The only thing that could pay our debt was the Creator actually sacrificing himself for the creation. It's the only thing that could pay our debt. It was too big. We could not pay it ourselves. And the ultimate price was paid when Jesus cried out on the cross, "It is finished." You see, God's forgiveness is exceeding and abundantly beyond anything we could ask for or even imagine. There's a song that I like by a band called the David Crowder Band. It's called How He Loves. And they say, if your grace were an ocean, we would all be sinking. That's how deep God's grace is. If God's grace was an ocean, we would just be drowning in it. The king is searching. The king is forgiving. There are two kingdoms. So the king's to-do list includes graciously forgiving debt we could never repay ourselves to bring us into that kingdom. And the final lesson of the fourth discourse is that those of us who have become dependent on Jesus and entered his kingdom must make the king's to-do list our to-do list. That's the last lesson. The king's to-do list must become our to-do list. That's how the parable of the unmerciful servant finishes. The parable of the unmerciful servant finishes after his debt has been forgiven. He goes and does a shakedown with one of his fellow servants for a few $100s. The king says, no, that's not how it works. My to-do list must become your to-do list. Forgiveness is on my to-do list, so forgiveness must be on your to-do list. The whole idea of the king searching out after his creation. You see in verses 15 down to verse 20, I skipped over this part, but this is what the rest of the chapter is about. The king says, I'm searching for people, and then he gives you a blueprint in 15 to 20. Here's how you can search for people. If I'm searching for people, you better be searching for people. You better make every effort to reconcile with a brother that sins against you. Go after them. Have multiple conversations. If it takes multiple conversations, make my to-do list your to-do list. I search, I forgive, you search, you forgive. What does this mean for our church? Well, for our church, it means that as we become a people dependent on the king to enter his kingdom, we must be willing to imitate the king. This is the cost of discipleship. And this is where I've entitled this sermon, True Discipleship. Because that's what true discipleship is all about. It's being willing to imitate the king. It's making the king's to-do list your to-do list. And so someone asked me this week, you know, who's the church for? Lost people or found people? Well, the king searches for lost people. But he rejoices when people are found. Who's the church for? Lost people or found people? Yes. And I pray that our church would be a place where lost people can be enfolded into the majesty of what it means to be in the king's kingdom, and where found people can grow up into full maturity, embracing true discipleship, imitating the king, making the king's to-do list our to-do list. And this is a messy proposition to have lost people and found people all together. But Jesus leaves a promise for those who will become dependent on him to the point of imitation. He leaves us a promise. And in verses 5, 20, and 10, he talks about his presence being with the church. His presence being with those who will imitate him and step out to make sure that what's on the king's heart is on their heart. And so this morning, as Alex comes forward to play our closing song, this morning, if you answer that question, I'm kind of in the independent category. Would you consider, as we sing this last song, moving toward dependence on the king? And if you answer the question, I'm in the dependent category, I want to be dependent on the king, would you consider making the king's to-do list your to-do list? For that is what true discipleship is all about. Let's stand and sing that together.